All right, good morning, everybody. We welcome you to our Bible class on this Lord's Day morning. We are in this series right now. We are using Paul's phrase, "I make my defense," which he uses in one form or another a couple of times in Acts 23 and 26. Both. These are passages where Paul tells the story of his own being a Christian in order to not only defend himself against efforts to eliminate him, but also to fulfill his mission of being someone who lends evidence and support to the truth of the gospel before governors and kings and Jews and Gentiles and the powerful and the not so and all kinds of situations. And we're trying to use this as a way for us to kind of contemplate our own privilege of trying to share the good news of Christ with people around us in a manner which is sensitive to the situation, to the persons to whom we have the privilege of relating, and in a manner which is also appropriate and personal. So we think these passages offer us a great opportunity to think about that in ourselves. Today we'll be at the end of Acts 22, the beginning of Acts 23, if you want to go ahead and look that up in your New Testament. We'll get to it in just a second. As we say, we're glad to have you here. If you are a guest here at Watermill today, thank you for stopping here or coming here to be with us. To all of you who are moms, we wish you a happy Mother's Day. To all families, we hope it's a time that can allow us to think about what's best within us and what our aspirations are, to enlist the Lord's help in our pursuit of them. So, those best wishes to you and your loved ones. This past week, in terms of who we need to pray over today, remember that our brother David White, who ordinarily would be sitting right here, had to go through surgery that ended up being maybe a more complicated loss of gallbladder things than is ordinary. Of course, David is a special guy anyway, so he has to not be ordinary. But he's back home now, and keep him and Ginger both in your prayers. Remember Brother Dennis Smith, and keep him in your thoughts. He was doing a little better, but he still certainly needs to be in our prayers. Remember Denzel Rains and Ruth as Denzel is recovering from another stay in the hospital. Anyone else that I haven't mentioned who needs to be in our prayer this morning? Yes, Faye? All right. Faye has important eye doctor visit on Tuesday, so please remember, okay? Oh, her brother is back in the hospital with a blood clot, she says. And remember, Faye's brother has had a series of challenges for a while, so bear that in mind in your prayer life, please. We have a number of families who've been celebrating graduations and such like in the last few days, and are rejoicing with them, and our prayers for them also, prayers of thanks. Anyone else, Chase? Okay. Chase keeps us updated on stories I may have missed, but he said the European countries, especially Spain and France right now, and the challenges that they've had. Anyone else? Yes. Oh, their sister-in-law Linda Gillum had a stroke, and we'd like to remember them in our prayers. Anyone else that you can think of today? I did not grab a mic for somebody. John, you think you could stand up and talk loudly enough for us to hear? Okay, if you lead us in our prayer today, we appreciate it. Amen. Thank you, John. I don't know how many of us in this room think of passing along good news as a daunting task. I think when it comes to, if I define good news as gospel, then it becomes more of a daunting task in our minds, it seems. And there is the idea that I have got to figure out an exact flow chart way of saying this so that I'll always say the right thing, and so that I'll know immediately how to respond to all of this, and therefore I have to have a method of doing this that maybe is fail-safe, and which would mean that nobody's ever thought of it before, and I have to learn to use that method just exactly right in order for that to happen, and in order for the passing along of the gospel to happen. The problem is that when you read the New Testament, that's not what you find going on. You find the Lord's word of the gospel of Christ being heard and taken in to people who make it a part of themselves, and then you find them able to talk about it or to talk of it in all kinds of situations and in different places where they meet people and different circumstances where conversations are started. Sometimes it's before a crowd, sometimes with one person, sometimes it's in connection with a religious meeting, sometimes it's out on the road to somewhere else. And that can happen because of what we have been we've been saying. When what you see it with Paul, even I hope you do, if one can know, why did I become a Christian? How did I become a Christian? And why have I remained a Christian? Then you have a basic outline for talking about these matters, and all you're doing is really having processed this in your own thoughts and minds so that you can put it in your own word, you can tell it. And what we've noticed with regard to Paul is the story of his becoming a Christian, how it happened, why it happened, is told by Luke in Acts chapter 9. But then it gets retold by Paul in different circumstances in which he highlights the details that fit that person to whom he's talking or that moment. So what we mean when we say making our talk about the gospel sensitive and appropriate is not adjusting the message so that it's a whole different story depending on currying the favor of who we're talking to. Okay, I don't think I did anything to that, but if I did, I apologize. At least we have your attention. You all who know me know I hate this mic, so that's one of the reasons why, maybe. So here's if we're thinking about this, and Paul is being attentive and sensitive and appropriate in what he says about the precious gospel of Christ. How does he change this? It's not the truth of it, but he knows, he identifies where to start and what to highlight in each one of these different stories. So what if there are tensions? What if he can identify tensions present which will impact how people hear what he has to say? So I want to invert a little bit what we have been saying. Remember, I've said that if you think of those questions and then you think of to whom am I speaking, and where are they coming from? I'll just put where are they here, and you know what I'm getting at. That seems to be the thing that impacts then how the other two parts of the story get told. Now, remembering what we've learned about in Luke 9 about how Paul became a Christian, about why, how, and why he remained a Christian, and then having noticed how he speaks of this before the Jewish crowd at the from the steps of the Tower of Antonio in Jerusalem in Acts 22, I want to come back a little bit to Acts 22 and 19. Remember that he's told the whole story of his becoming a Christian, and then he mentioned what happened when he came back to Jerusalem and the Lord appearing to him and telling him, as I understand it, this would have been 3 years after he became a Christian, and telling him to hurry and get out of Jerusalem quickly. This would be Acts 22 and verse 18. They won't accept your testimony about me. Now notice that Paul thought, in his mind, he would have been the perfect one to bear witness to the gospel of Christ in Jerusalem. He thought, they'll know my background, they'll know where I came from, they'll know I wouldn't have changed unless there's a good reason, they'll listen to me. No, look what he says, verse 19 to 20. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you, and when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing nearby and approving and watching over the cloaks of those who were killing him. Now, I read that at least as him saying, they'll listen to me. I have credibility with them. They know how much I was convinced about this. You can kind of see what Paul is thinking. The Lord said, go, for I'll send you far away to the Gentiles. Now, we remember from the other records, there's some other details here that he finds out about his mission that he doesn't mention right here. In this case, though, they're about to tear him apart because the rumor is he brought a Gentile to the temple. It wasn't true, but that was the rumor. And he is, at this point, he's mentioning his mission to the Gentiles in his defense of his handling of the gospel. Well, they listened to him up to this point. And then it stirred up the rage even more. We've read about that, the tossing of their cloaks and everything in the air, and the dust in the air, and the as if it was a grief or a mourning, and the turmoil that existed. The commander orders him to be brought to the barracks, where he's going to be interrogated by flogging. What did that mean? What's the point of that? This is Acts. He's going to be questioned by flogging. Acts 22, verse 24. Anybody tell me? All right, he's going to be beaten with the whip under the supposition of what? All right, if we wear him out enough with the terrible tool of flogging, which was not only a whip, but one that had strands on it and sometimes particular things attached to it so that it would do more damage, we'll get the truth out of him that way. The problem is that was not a method which was allowed to be used with Roman citizens. A Roman citizen had to have complete due process, and he could not be treated this way. This was not an option for a Roman citizen. So notice that Paul waits till they have him stretched out with the strap, and then he says to the centurion who's standing nearby, Is it lawful for you to flog a man who's a Roman and uncondemned? That created a new silence in the situation. The other one happened when Paul spoke in Hebrew to the crowd, verse 1, back up there. Now then, the centurion heard this. He's the responsible one there in that situation. And he goes to the tribune or the commander and says, "What are you about to do? This fellow's a Roman." And then notice the commander comes to Paul and says, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he says, "Yes." And the commander answers, "I acquired this citizenship for a large sum of money." Do you think he said that? And what was that, sarcasm, or was it? What was he saying there? That Roman citizenship was highly valued. It cost me a lot. But Paul says, "I was actually born a citizen." Now, remember where he was from? Remember Saul of Tarsus in Cilicia? So it had something to do with that situation. We don't know all the other details about his family, but apparently a more wealthy situation, and one in which they had awareness of the Greek culture, but also of the Roman world. And then it says, therefore, Paul says, therefore those who are about to interrogate him, it says, about to interrogate him, immediately backed away from him. And the commander also was afraid when he found out he was a Roman, and because he had put Paul in chains. So the one who is on trial has now put the responsible authorities on trial. Has Paul said anything about the gospel in this particular snippet? Why? Timing, it wasn't the right time, was it? They weren't listening to gospel or any other kind of news from him. And second, what had to be defended in this situation is not the gospel, but his life, his survival. So what he does is to use the rights and the privileges of the secular world or the political world to sustain his presence in the picture so that he could continue the mission that the Lord had for him. It isn't wrong for people who have the rights of citizenship to employ them in protecting themselves or in surviving. It is wrong for Christians to walk around making themselves the center of attention in all circumstances. And that's not what Paul was doing here. He was surviving. So the next day, verse 30, wanting to know for certain why Paul had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble. And he brought Paul down and placed him before him. He released him, but he still brought him and placed him before him. So maybe he is letting him go from whatever protective custody he's in, has been in terms of chains or anything like that. So now then, what we have is Paul before the council. I've used quite a bit of our time to get to this point, haven't I? Paul before the council. What's the council here? What are we talking about? Where are they coming from? All right. What's the other term by which the council is known? All right, the Sanhedrin. Now, in the recent background, what's the Sanhedrin's track record for people in the New Testament story who have been brought before them that we know about? For example, one of them was named Jesus. Describe to me the justice administered. Now, you kind of have a two-tier deal. The Romans are the the ones who have the governorship and so forth in Jerusalem. But the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, has the religious rule in Jerusalem. The religious rulers in Jerusalem, where they could sustain a charge that that deserved the extreme penalty, could only be allowed to enforce that penalty with the permission of the Roman political rulers. So the Roman political ruler can see that there is a rage going on here about Paul, but he can't find out why. So he's calling the Sanhedrin to see if he can find out what really the charge against Paul is. Of course, there was not only Paul, but not only Jesus, but Stephen, and now Paul in this situation. So here we have Paul in the Roman rule situation there near the temple, talking to the Jewish council about the gospel. Now, does he tell the same story in the same way that he had? Does he tell it like Luke told it in Acts 9? Does he tell it like he told it to himself and the whole group in Acts 22? Or what does he do now? No, it's a whole different situation, you notice. Looking intently at the council, verse 1, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life with an entirely good conscience before God up to this day." Why was that important? Why start that way? Let me jot it down up here. I have lived my life with an entirely good conscience before God. Where is Paul starting now in the story he has to tell? All right. This even reaches back to when he was persecuting Stephen. He thought he was Christians. He thought he was justified before that. The one thing that always has to be done in talking with anybody about the gospel is to identify a place where you have common ground or where you have common authority with them. In this case, Paul can't do it with having seen Jesus on the road to Damascus because they've ruled Jesus out. He can't do it because reasoning from Old Testament scripture because he has already tried to say that with the crowd in Acts 22. He can't start with his conversation with Ananias or his baptism. He's already discussed that with them. The only authority that both Paul and the religious leaders on the council can both recognize at this point is the good conscience part of this. What is conscience? What is the function of the conscience? Pardon? All right, your belief system informs your conscience, but what does your conscience do? All right, it either approves or accuses. It either condemns or approves of your choices and your actions and your thoughts. Now, is a conscience always a fail-safe guide? No, what was just said about Paul's behavior before toward Christians and even toward Stephen and towards Jesus was good proof of that. But can you be on the right course when your conscience does not approve of what you're doing? No, you can't. No, you can't. Because we have to find out that our conscience is, we have to find out enough about it to inform our conscience that our choice is proper in order for it to be proper. The end of Romans 14 might be a good example of this. So I left out lived, by the way. I have lived my life. Now, this would mean in this discussion here, if you're thinking about it, his opponents would have to do what in order to combat that statement? In this tense moment, if there really is a problem to be dealt with Saul of Tarsus, at this moment, what would his opponents on the council have needed to do? They would need to offer a case in point where it would have been inappropriate for Paul to claim to have lived with good conscience. He is claiming here to have lived before God in all good conscience. That is, according to what he knew of God's law, according to what he knew of God's ways and God's will, which means that if these people are going to put before the trial setting there an accusation against Paul, it needs to show where it would have gone against conscience, and it needs to show where it would have gone against God. All right, so kind of be aware. This is a starting place here in a tense situation. And it's going to be not just where one person says, I think this. It's going to mean we're going to have to discuss this rationally and give a case in point where we know what God wants. All right? Now, the high priest Ananias, who, by the way, was a terrible guy. He was high priest, I think I read, from 47 to 58 A.D., and he ended up being assassinated by a zealot in 66 A.D. He was a person who was avaricious, and he was a political chameleon, and he was someone who was self-serving in every way. The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. A perfectly logical argument to a point having been made, right? Someone says he has a good conscience before God, and you whack him, you have someone to whack him across the mouth, and what have you proved in that moment? You haven't proved anything. You've demonstrated that this is not an exercise in conscience at all. And the approval of God is not the point at all. So, to discuss whether one needs to repent, or whether one needs to be baptized, or whether Jesus is the Son of God in this situation here, this isn't the time for it, is it? This isn't the spot for that. This isn't what's going on. Paul said to him, God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law? Do you order me to be struck? Verse 3. Was that a good point? Yeah, that's a good point. There was, however, I am not going to criticize Paul for what he said myself, but there was a statement in the law that you not speak against the high priest this way, and I think what is it? Exodus 22, verse 28, I believe is right. But this is exactly Paul's claim and the guy's action and having him smitten on the mouth or hit on the mouth proves that Paul's point is right. He was a whitewashed wall, and he was acting as if to try him by the law, but acting also in violation of the law. You didn't treat someone this way. And then those present said, "Are you insulting God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I was not aware, brothers, that he is high priest." If you really wanted to be cynical about it, you could think that Paul is saying, "I didn't know a guy like this could be high priest." That's how I would have done it. But that's also why I'm not Paul. Okay. "For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people." So Paul is in verse 5 then. Paul is giving deference to the seat or the place the guy occupies and not to the guy himself or not to the person and his corrupt behavior. All right, now what do you do in this situation? Verse 6, "But Paul, perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, began crying out in the council, 'Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of the Pharisees. I'm on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.'" What did Paul do there, and was that an honorable approach? Yeah. Did he divide them or expose the divisions that already existed there? What he did is to expose in another way the unjust and partisan and self-interest spirit of the crowd that was there before him, to illustrate that they weren't looking for the truth about him, but instead that they had other axes that they were grinding in their own lives. Back in Mark 12, in its parallels, during the ministry of Jesus, we met the truth about the Pharisees and the Sadducees already. The Sadducees, you remember, are the guys who conspire with the Herodians and so forth, the Herod party. They are the guys who are the more secular. They're the guys who want to cooperate and curry the favor of the Roman authorities and so forth. And they also were the one, the Sadducees were the ones who were materialists, basically. They say there's no resurrection. And remember they had this rigged up question where they thought they were trapping Jesus. Jesus pointed them to the living God. But notice here, "I'm on trial for the hope of the resurrection." So what Paul has done here is to go to the central core fact of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It looks to us like he just is manipulating a division, a dissension among the people. But what he's doing is, since they have proven that they're not looking for whether he is acting properly himself, he holds up the central, the basic, the core fact of the gospel of Christ, the one point in which if there's an unwillingness to accept it, nothing else is going to convince anybody: the resurrection of the dead. Now, not just the resurrection of the dead theoretically and generally, but of course all of this, the proof that there is such a thing is the resurrection of Christ. Now it goes ahead to say, when he said this, a dissension occurred among the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And therefore, their authority toward Paul, if it ever existed, was non-existent. For the Sadducees say there's no resurrection, nor angel, nor a spirit. The Sadducees, in other words, there's no spiritual world, there's no later on hope, there's no resurrection of the body, there's none of the, only this world, and only who gets the power and who gets the riches in this world, and who engages in the proper religious ceremony in this world. That's all. But the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There is a resurrection, there are angels, there is a spirit, there is an entire spiritual realm that we can't see. Now, if you think about it that way, what Paul is doing here is making them confront what they believe. And one of the things that's obvious here, if you think about it, is in a world which tries to convince us, if you are religious, you have these beliefs, we don't have any, we are not religious. Paul exposes that in this situation, and he makes the crowd confront what they believe. Think about another thing here, an interesting thing. Could you be a Pharisee and become a Christian and still be a Pharisee? I mean, in terms of basic views of reality and of the world. Could you be a Pharisee and become a Christian and still be a Pharisee? As long as you didn't try to make everybody else do it, you could keep on practicing the law and be strict about it and so on. But you believe there's a resurrection, you believe there are angels and spirits, there'll be a judgment and so forth. Could you be a Sadducee and become a Christian and remain a Sadducee? Why not? You didn't believe in the resurrection. That's the key, and you don't believe in the resurrection, you don't really believe in the Christ, and therefore you haven't really been responsive to the gospel. Verse 9 now, the Pharisees acknowledge them all, and then what happens as a result of this? Are people convinced? No, they're not convinced. They weren't looking to be. What happens is there's a great uproar, and some of the scribes and Pharisees' party stood up and started arguing heatedly. We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. Ah, there's the possibility. And when a great dissension occurred, the commander was afraid that Paul would be torn in pieces by them, and he ordered the troops to go down and take him away from there by force and bring him into the barracks. Had Paul failed as an evangelist? Was Paul a poor good news teller because these people didn't become Christians that day? No. What Paul did is to deal with these two things here in this picture. To whom is he talking, and where are they? And then he addressed that situation with his good conscience and with the resurrection. I didn't write it down. That should be the other point, with the hope of the resurrection. That then exposed the view of things that the council had. And if they had been thinking about it, would have exposed the human condition in which they found themselves. That, too, is an important part of the telling of the good news of Christ. Maybe some of these people opened their hearts later on. I hope they did. I hope they weren't able to forget what Paul said that day and how they acted. I don't know that. But I can see the wisdom, at least, in what Paul did here. And I can think of ways to try to emulate that approach when I am dealing with the gospel where there are tensions present. Good conscience before God and a view of the world which allows for the resurrection of the dead. In some settings, that's the proper approach to take. Thank you for being with us today. We'll get ready for our assembly now.